This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all Have Another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is indeed Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you on yet another Hall of Fame edition of the program. But before we get started, I do want to extend a very special welcome to everybody who is joining us around the country, throughout North America, on Sirius 220 and XM 206, and everyone listening around the globe on our website, horseracingradio.net. I mentioned this show being a Hall of Fame edition. We've had this on different occasions throughout the past year or so where I have the opportunity to visit with a Hall of Fame trainer. And tonight's show, very, very special. I want to welcome Hall of Famer Bob Baffert to the program. The 61-year-old native of Nogales, Arizona, has trained 2,504 winners in his Hall of Fame career. That is to date. That career is still going strong. His runners have earned more than $209 million. He has saddled three Kentucky Derby winners, five Preakness winners, a Belmont Stakes winner, and 10 Breeders' Cup champions. Bob has received three Eclipse Awards as the nation's leading trainer, and in 2009 was inducted into Racing's Hall of Fame. And Bob, an absolute thrill to have you on the program here today.
What? It didn't seem like I've done all that. It just, where did all the money go?
Yeah, $209 million. You're going to buy coffee when we finish up here.
I'm telling you.
Yeah, mate. What goes through your mind when you listen to me run through those accolades? And that's only a portion of it.
Well, the 2,509, I remember I was at Hollywood Park, and I won a race, and somebody said, "You just won your 2,000th race." And I thought, really? I thought I'd won more than that, you know? And so so I went, I remember going downstairs to the winner's circle, and I run into Jerry Hollendorfer. He was down there. He goes, "Jerry, I just won my 2,000th race." I said, "How many have you won?" He said, "I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000, whatever." See, well, so what's the big deal? You know, like, I mean, he said it like it was like off the, you know, like no big deal, but you know what? It's really, it's incredible because this whole journey of mine started back in Nogales, Arizona, the border town, which I grew up on a little cattle ranch, and we had chickens that we sold eggs to the local town there. And so,
not a mayonnaise farm.
Oh, I'm telling you what, I would have been better off being born on a mayonnaise farm, but, it was a great way to grow up, especially as a child. You know, here in Southern California, I know my kids here, you know, we raise them on concrete, you know, so it's not like I was a kid living in the country at the time. And so as you're growing up, you get to experience a lot of things on a ranch, you know, with cattle, and you have responsibilities at a very young age. You know, as we were growing up, we had to take care of feeding some of the cattle and some of the chickens and all that. So right away, we were taught responsibility from a very from the get-go. So, and now with our kids, when we get older, you know, you don't want them to go through that. You know, what do you need? You know,
sure.
You want to go to Toys R Us today or whatever? We didn't have that, you know. So, I was brought up that way, and luckily for me, my father, who loved horses, he had a couple quarter horse mares that were just mares that weren't, they, you know, and he found out they were bred, you know, to race. So he decided to breed one of them, and he sent it to some trainer in Tucson Relito, you know, to train. And my father would put the name Baffert in front of all the foals. Like the
really?
First one was called Baffert's Heller, was the okay. First one. because he was by some Ed Heller mare or something. That's where it came from. And so I remember watching it run and win. He was a beautiful horse. And then it was Baffert's Ballot, and he sent him to Texas, to Del Rio or somewhere. Wait, really? I don't know why he did that. See, he got caught. He got hooked up with some guys that, hey, send your horse down here.
Sure. How old were you at that time?
I was young. I was like, I want to say I was like 10 years old.
Okay.
And and then I remember it. So then later on, when Baffert Teller came back, I think he won one race. He didn't do much, but he was really a beautiful gelding. But he was sort of a tough horse to ride, and he had one of the ranch hands make a riding horse out of him. So I started riding him when I was like probably 12.
Okay.
And he was tough, and he knew, he was really smart. When I got on him, he would just try to buck me off. He would rub me against the fence to rub my legs on. I mean, he knew that.
Wow.
I was, they know. And then I'd get off, and one of the cowboys would get on him, and he was like perfect. He knew that they, you know, they had the, they showed him. So
did he ever get you off of him?
No, but I was scared of him, you know. And so it took me about 6 months, and I remember I was riding back on the school bus, and I was remembering, how am I, I've got to overcome this horse. Is just, you know, he's, and I had a cousin at the time that he rode also, and so we decided, I told him, you know, I'm going to ride him today. I'm going to show that horse. So I remember I put my spurs on, I got on him, and I started to kick him, and he starts like, he wouldn't really buck, he was just like hump up a little bit, and he would start like, and he wouldn't, you know, he knew he was, he could handle me. And I remember holding on the horn, I just started yelling at him and spurring him, and just kept on going and going, and finally he started bucking. I just kept going like I wasn't scared of him, and all of a sudden, next thing you know, I could do anything on him. I just had to show him,
really,
that he knew I was scared. And then once I did that, he never gave me another problem. It was like, and I'm telling you what, for 6 months, I was like being bullied by this horse. It's like being bullying.
Right.
It was really bothering me. And so I really learned a lot about, you know, the personality of horses, that, you know, if they know you're scared of them and you're on top of them, they'll, you know, they're going to do what they want to do.
Did you ever have any thoughts of being a jockey at that point in your life?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to be a jockey. When I started going to the races with my father, we'd go to all these little fair meets, and then he had another horse we bred, and we'd go to, I loved going to Sullen Park. We'd go there, we'd drive there, and there was this little, we'd go buy tack, and it was a place called Johnny Bean's. It was like, that's where you bought all the good tack, you know, because they didn't really have it in Arizona.
Sure.
So we'd go to Johnny Bean's, and I remember seeing, you'd buy all these liniments, and you'd buy all these, we bought all our saddles, our head stalls, everything. I mean, he had it all the furry stuff. And so that's where we used to get our stuff. And we'd go to the races at Sunland Park. And to me, Sunland Park was like big time. It was really, really big time.
Yeah.
Because during the races, they have a little lake, and they had these skiers do these jumps. I remember that as a little boy, you know.
Really?
Watching all that.
Yeah.
You know, they still do it, I think. But
and that was just quarter horses, right? Did they have any thoroughbreds?
They ran thoroughbreds, but they had quarter horses. They ran a few thoroughbreds. I never really, you know, the thoroughbreds weren't that really that good.
Yeah.
So it is mainly quarter horses. So so I grew up with that, and so and you know, every year we'd make the trip, you know, to Johnny Bean's, or, you know, it was just fun. You know, you walk into this, it smells like vitamin B1. It smells like vitamins, you know, We'd buy all this stuff and go home, and I would sit in the back seat, and I would use saddle soap. I saddle soaped all the stuff all the way back. It was like a 6-hour ride back to Nogales.
Right.
So I did all the tech all the way. I'd oil it, saddle soap it. That was my job. So
wow.
I became the groom. I was the groom, hot walker / everything, you know, for my dad. So so he decided he was going to maybe train himself. So we had some land there that we had all this equipment. We used to, you know, bale hay there. So I knew how to drive a tractor when I was young. So I'd go out there, and we just got a little place, and for a little straightaway for a track. And that's basically how I learned. I just taught myself how to gallop. It was tough, you know, because I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
And fell off a lot. But that's basically how I got my start. I remember starting to break my own horses, and it was where he cut out this track. We had to go around these mesquite trees, and I had a horse one time just take off with me, and for some reason just took off underneath the mesquite trees, and I got clotheslined right in the chest. I'll never forget that. It was like, and my mother was always against all this, but every time I got clotheslined or got knocked off a horse or something bad happened,
that didn't help.
First thing my father would say, are you okay? I go, yeah. Do not tell your mother what happened. You know, that was the main thing, you know. So I'm just this little, you know, 13-year-old kid. I'm just like, hey, you put me through all this. But that's the way it was then, you know. You didn't worry about, oh, you got to worry about this or that.
Yeah.
You know, just, but
your dad must have been thrilled when you decided that you wanted to kind of somewhat follow in his footsteps and be involved with horses. Was he happy with that?
Well, you know what? We were really close. Not only he was my dad, but we were like best friends. Because I remember when I was getting older and, you know, going to through high school, he used to pick me up. And I wanted to be a jockey then, he'd pick me up. I was 15 years old when school was out. He'd show up, he had my boots, my saddle, my whip, my helmet, and we'd go out to this little match race ranch. There's a little farm out there, and they'd had a two-horse gate.
Sure.
And I'd go out there, and they'd have these little, it was, you know, they bet a few bucks. It wasn't serious money, but it was a lot of beer drinking and talking, telling stories, and just something to, it was entertainment. You know, people golf, we go to the match races. And so once in a while, I get lucky, and I pick up a mount. I get 50 bucks if I rode a horse. So at that time, I was 15, you know, 50 bucks. It went a long way, you know.
Huge.
So, and then I'd ride a horse, and I remember that we had this one straightaway, and there was a barbed wire fence on the left side of it, and they wanted me to ride a race, but they wanted me to ride with the overgirth. It's
okay.
Called the faja in Spanish, where you put a golf ball in your each front pocket, and you sit on the horse bareback, but you move your legs like, and this overgirth goes over underneath. And it holds you on there. You can't get out.
Okay.
And the golf balls keep it from slipping down.
Yeah.
So it goes over your leg and then your ankle. So I'm in the gate. It's sort of like a death trap because you're in the gate. If the horse flips in the gate, it's going to hurt you pretty badly.
The barbed wire fence doesn't sound like a lot of fun either.
So the barbed wire fence was on the left, but the track was, you know, it was wide enough for like, you know, it was probably wide enough for three horses.
Okay.
You know, it was a little strip down there, and all the people are down below. But I never forget. I was always told if a horse is running, you know, these guys were telling me, if a horse is going towards a rail or something or a fence, if you throw them their head, they'll see it and they won't go through it. But if you turn their head, they're going to go right through it because, you know, that's what you learn. So it's like when you're in the snow, turn into the turn.
Yeah.
Turn... It's hard,
right?
Because you want to go the opposite way.
Yeah.
So I was on this horse, and he just blew away from the gate. And I'm out there, and he's in front. And all of a sudden, he just bolted and left. And he's headed right for that barbed wire fence. And I have his head turned all the way around. I'm trying to, and I'm coming at it, and I can't get out.
You're strapped in.
I can't jump.
Yeah.
I'll never forget. And I go, I kept thinking, oh, turn their head loose. I don't know about this, and I'll never forget. I said, all right, here it goes, and I just threw the reins at him, and I grabbed a hold of the mane, and I came to the fence, and I closed my eyes, and I just said, this is really going to hurt. And that's it. That's all you can do. And sure enough, that horse just saw the fence and ducked back out. He just barely just touched it, and I opened my eyes, and I came out of it. I was like, oh, you know, it works, you know, like, wow, man, I just like, you know, could have killed me right there. But I mean, things like that.
And you didn't tell your mother.
Of course not. I never told my mother. So, but I remember one time we wanted to break this horse out of the gate. And this one guy is the only one that had a starting gate. So we went there with a trailer, but we needed somebody to go with us to to open the gate, to pull the lever. So, and somebody inside the gate. So my mother was the only one that was around. So we had her come with us. And so we explained to her, this is safe, whatever. We're going to break out of the gate. We need you to, you pull the lever. And he was in the gate. You know, he was going to help me come out of the gate. He was going to smack him out of the gate, or just with his, just, you know, we tap him out with your hand to make him go. So we're ready to go. And she goes, I remember she was going like, I don't know if I can do this. You know, she was worried. She was nervous. I said, just pull it, you know, we give, you know. So finally she pulled it, and then I took off. Well, I left there like yelling, you know, like, you know, to get it rolling for about, you know, the first 30, 40, 50 yards.
Right.
And when I did that, when I came back, she was crying, and she was like, when I started yelling, she thought I was falling. She told my father, see, he's in trouble. He's falling off. He's yelling and screaming. So we never did that again. So, but she would come to my races when I was a jockey, but she would not. She wouldn't watch. She couldn't watch. She had to go downstairs, and she just couldn't. You know, she was too. She was always worried about us. She's the kind of mother that there was seven of us, and if we went out partying or on a Friday night, Saturday night, whatever, she would sit down there and read a book, and in the living room until everybody came in.
Really?
It was like you have to check in with her.
Yeah.
And as soon as everybody
was
in,
she wouldn't go to bed until everybody was in.
She would not go to bed until everybody was in, because she was just, you know, just sit there and read her book. And I mean, that's the kind of mother she was. Or else, if she did go to bed, we had to open the door and say, hey, I'm home.
I'm okay.
You know, she was just, you had to do the check-in.
When did she finally come around to you being involved with horses and doing what you do now?
Well, she always thought that I was wasting my time with the horses, because we didn't do that well. My dad, we'd go, and, you know, our horses weren't really that good. And we had one decent horse and was okay. And then when I decided I wanted to be like a horse trainer and I was going to the University of Arizona, she said, you know what? Why are you messing with it? You know what? You need to go to school, get an education, and get a real job. This horse thing, I mean, you know. But once horse racing gets in your blood, there's no rehab for it. You can go for a rehab for drinking or drugs or whatever. For racing, once it's in your blood, it's stuck. Once you get the bug. But I had the bug, and I was, you know, I've always been very competitive, and but I just loved the horses. So what I would do, I was going to college at the U of A, and I'd go first thing in the morning. I made sure I took classes that didn't start till after 10 o'clock, so I would go and gallop horses, quarter horses, in the morning for like $5 a mount, and that was my spending money for the week.
Okay.
So it was like so it was great, and plus I loved it. I'd go up, get up early, go gallop horses, and go to class and have a little extra cash to spend. And I was in a fraternity, so it was a lot of fun. So it was like, you know, it was like my college days were just, it was great.
Yeah.
I go back there, and U of A is like, talk about a party school. I mean, it was really.
You never got involved in any of that.
I would never, if I had a doctor and they told me they went to the U of A, I said, no, I got to get another doctor. You know, I got to get somebody that was really serious, you know, going to school.
Talking with Hall of Fame trainer Bob Baffert here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. You mentioned that relationship with your dad, and you said that he was really your best friend. And, of course, you lost him a couple of years ago. What's the most valuable lesson that he taught you as you were growing up?
You know what he used to say, and he really taught us how to be like, you know, when you shake somebody's hand, your word is good. You know, if you're going to do something, keep your word. And he said, always tell the truth, then you don't, because he didn't want us lying, you know.
Sure.
If you don't lie, you don't have to remember. That's what his famous words were.
Good advice.
You know, and never wisen up a dummy. That was one all the time. And never argue with a dummy, because nothing good can come out of it, you know. So, but it was like, he taught us, you know, the right way to grow up. You know, you just don't, you know, you do what's right. You got to do what's right, even though it might not, you know, it might either hurt you financially or emotionally. You have to do, if you say you're going to do something, you got to do it. You know, you just got to be that way. And I think that's really, and I try to you know, I tell my kids the same way, you know, sometimes you just do the right thing. Don't be sneaky. Don't be just do it. You know? Yeah. So I think that's very important.
So where did the training career of Bob Baffert officially begin?
Well, it started, I had this one horse that we raised, my dad raised it, and his name was Pete Hoist. And I don't know why he named him that, but he was decently bred, and I took him to, he'd qualify for these futurities around, you know, you have to run and a week later, and he'd always be the fastest qualifier, but then he'd run third or fourth in the finals. He was the best horse, and it was just aggravating to the point where I finally had him in. I remember I was in Globe, Arizona, and but before that, I had him in. I was at Kingman, Arizona.
Okay.
I've been to some spots. Believe me, I've been in some spots. People think, oh yeah, Bob Baffert came in. He's got all these good horses. They don't know where I started, dude. I'm like, so I had him in the futurity, and he was a fastest qualifier, and it was in the finals. And my dad, he drove up from Nogales to watch him, and we were the favorite. And I'll never forget. One morning, this guy, Ray Yeh, he's a horse trainer, and his grandmother, he was from Wyoming, and it was like they found some oil, gas wells on their property, and all of a sudden they came in his money, and he loved the horses, and he had been ruled off. He was training, he had this nice horses, but Ray was a nice guy, but his horses were like, he wasn't really, he had some good stock, but for some reason, he just wasn't having any luck,
okay.
You know. And so, he has this horse that he was going to run in a futurity later on down the road. It was a nice horse, so they told me he needed to work it. So my friends, this John Bassett, who was a horse trainer at the time, and they said, you should work that horse to find out, you know, how good he is. I said, man, I really don't. I'm all showered up, got my white shirt on, ready for the races. So they talked me into it, and I had these riding boots. So I take the horse up there on the stretch, and it watered the track, and I start working him like 350 yards, you know. He starts working, and he starts like to get out a little bit. He's legging out a little bit. So I hit him on the shoulder, and he's still legging out. So I uncock my stick, and I go to hit him right hand. I hit him on the shoulder right-handed, and the second time I go to hit him, I guess he didn't like it. He just ducked out. And next thing you know, I'm hitting him on the left-hand shoulder, and I'm like, and he's running. He's going fast.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, boy, I'm going to fall.
This is going to hurt.
It's going to hurt, man. It's going to hurt. I fell off this horse. And when I hit the ground, he came back over and ran, and he stepped on my sternum. I had this silver aluminum plate right down my white shirt, and he just peeled all my skin back on my chest.
Ooh.
And I'm laying there, and I can't move. I mean, I've been lucky. I've been in some wrecks, but I couldn't breathe. It just knocked the air out of me, and I'm laying there, and the horse stopped, turned around, ran back to the top of the stretch again. So this John Bassett, he drives up there in his truck, and he goes, I go, are you okay? And he says, God, this hurts, man. And I go, why? And I'm thinking, why did I do this?
Right.
I didn't want to do this. So I walk up, I get up, I could really, really hurt my chest to breathe. So I went underneath the rail, I get in his truck, and I go, well, let's go get him. He ran back up on the top by the 440 chute. So I put my feet up, and I'm still moaning. I'm going, oh. And then he starts laughing. I go, what are you laughing at? I don't make me laugh. He's laughing. He says, look at the heels of your boot. I hit so hard, the heels of my boot had fallen off.
That's the heels fell off.
They fell off.
Wow.
It just blew my heels out. I mean, that's how hard I hit. So I go, well, get up there. What are you going to do? I says, help me. I says, I'm going to work them. I'm going to get back on them. I was mad then. The horse was just staying there. We got walked up. He put me back on him. So now I worked them, but I didn't hit him or nothing. I just came down there like I made it. I came back. And then my father, he's mad at me. I told you not to do that. Look at you. And I unbuckle my shirt, my skin, it's all bleeding. I had to go back to the hotel. I was in pain. I was in super pain.
You were always very determined, though, weren't you?
Oh, I just did not. I just had to do it. So I get ready to run my horse. I'll never forget. I was with John Bassett. And all of a sudden, they're going behind the gate. They're loading the gate. And I go, oh, the adrenaline. I go, oh, my chest. You know what? I don't feel it now. It's getting better. And they broke, and my horse breaks horribly. And he gets wiped out, doesn't break. And my friend, he wins the race, and my horse ran like fourth or fifth. And as soon as I crossed the water, like, oh, my chest is killing me again. I mean, and I'll never forget that. So then I took him to another meet at Globe, Arizona, which was about a couple of weeks later. And he did the same thing. He qualified fastest, and he came back, and he ran second. He got beat. And I thought, you know what? I'm so disgusted. You know what? I just can't take this, the punishment. I just can't win the big one. So I just, you know what? I just quit. I said, I'm done. So I went back to Nogales, and I started to, my mother, who was a principal at the elementary school, she hooked me up with, if you had a teacher degree, you could substitute.
Okay.
So I just did that.
So she must have been thrilled.
So she was thrilled, yeah. You know, so I did that. So I'm just going to do this for a while, and I just go to Tucson and party. And whatever I made, I just went and partied at Tucson at the, you know,
right
up there. We had a place up there. So finally that summer, I got a job at a that was getting old when the summer was over. So I got a job at this place. It was a veterinarian, not a veterinarian, but it's where you buy saddles and tack and a lot of medications for, like, cattle feed, you know, like vitamins for,
okay,
it's a lot to Mexico. They've come up from Mexico, the dairy farmers. So I deliver stuff to the dairy farmers or the pig farms. And going to a pig farm, oh, that's the most disgusting. Oh, that's disgusting. I'm telling you, that's another story. But that so I was doing that for a few months, and all of a sudden I got a job offer to run this little farm in Prescott Downs. This guy that I'd known, he had five brood mares. Wanted to know if I would come up there, and he'd pay me, like, at the time I was making, I think I was making like $300 a week.
Okay.
I mean,
and what are you at this point? Maybe in your early 20s or mid 20s, somewhere in there.
Well, I'm 25 probably, okay. 26.
Yep.
And so, so then I decided to, so I said, yeah, I'll take that job. Prescott in the summer. Oh, I'm gonna go do it. So I got up there and I did that, and then the guy said, maybe we'll buy a horse. Why don't you buy a horse, and we'll run him in the Prescott Futurity. So I went to Los Alamitos, and I called a friend, and Bobby Adair, the jockey. I said, do you know? He says, yeah, I got a horse you can buy. His name is Bishop Cat. He won $17,000 for him. He just won for $10,000. So I said, all right. So we bought him. So they shipped him over, but he was a really bad stall walker. He could run, but he was just, I mean, so I remember I had to make special hobbles for him because he was just driving me crazy, you know. So I ran him. He qualifies for the Futurity. But part of the deal is Bobby Adair had to come ride the horse.
Okay.
So that was a lot of fun because he was a great rider. He was, when I was young, I wanted to be Bobby Adair. He was a jockey, and he was the greatest quarter horse jockey. So
hold that thought for 1 minute, Bob. We have to get to a break. We're going to continue with Hall of Fame trainer Bob Baffert here on Trainer Talk. It's all presented by Fasig Gipton. Great stories. Stay with us for the second half coming up next.
The Fasig Tipton November sale is the market leader. The 2013 November sale had the highest average of any mixed sale in the world, with 24 horses selling for $1 million and higher, more than any other breeding stock sale in the world. And the 2013 November sale provided an outstanding weanling market with a $500,000 foal and a $100,000 plus average, while also producing the highest priced horse sold in North America last year when Better, Better, Better went under the gavel at $5.2 million. The Fasig Tipton November sale, Monday, November 3rd in Lexington, Kentucky. The market leader.
Hanson keeps going. Union Rags, Hanson, and Union Rags, Hanson. The more they ask, the more he gave, and Hansen, what a thriller!
Eclipse champion two-year-old Hansen. Look for his first weanling selling this November. His sire, Tappet, is the clear leader on the general sire list, which has created more interest than ever in Sons of Tappet. Hansen is the North American Eclipse Award-winning colt by Tappet and his leading money-earning male in the U.S. Visit HansenFoals.com.
For racing coverage from the inside out.
I still kicked away and I thought I really had it until the 16th pole. Amazing little horse.
International English events.
A clear round and under the time limit will get you into the jump off.
And hard-fought Western competition.
Here we go, guys. Let's help him. You bet.
Woo!
Tune in to HRTV, the network for horse sports. Online at HRTV.com.
The Daily Racing Form NTRA National Handicapping Championship is coming off the most exciting championship in the event's 15-year history. Virtually every tournament this year, on track and online, is filling to capacity, and the purse for the 2015 NHC is expected to be $2 million. And there's still plenty of time to join the tour and get in on the action. NHC Tour membership is only $50 and includes all sorts of discounts and special offers on DRF past performance and other products. Go to NHCTour.com today. That's NHCTour.com.
Imagine having 80 channels of live, full card, uninterrupted simulcast feeds delivered direct to your home television for just $50 a month. Choose from your favorite thoroughbred, harness, quarter horse, and greyhound tracks in North America and internationally. Call Dish Network at 1-888-677-5487 and ask for RTN, the Racetrack Television Network. RTN is the only place where you can see every race from every simulcast every day.
HRRN is your home for the 2014 Breeders' Cup Championships. We'll bring you over 17 hours of coverage during Breeders' Cup Week, leading up to our exclusive broadcasts of the Breeders' Cup World Championships, October 31st and November 1st, live from Santa Anita. Go to horseracingradio.net for a complete schedule of times, affiliates, SiriusXM info, or to listen live online. The Breeders' Cup World Championships, only on HRRN. This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Basic Tipton.
This is Eddie Delahousie. You're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Mike Penna visiting with Hall of Fame trainer Bob Baffert. Really great stories in the first half of the program and continuing here in the second half. And Bob, as we went to break, you were telling the story of qualifying for the Futurity. And what an amazing story, just part of that legacy of Bob Baffert that people might not know about.
Well, Prescott Downs was, to me, it was big time. We loved going there in the summer. It was the greatest place they had. And then the weekends, they had Whiskey Row. It was it's a party, especially during the summer. It was just everybody from Phoenix, Arizona would come to Prescott. That's like it was like Del Mar.
Yeah.
It had that same vibe.
Okay.
And so, but it was a Western vibe. And you got to remember, I'm a cowboy. I wear a cowboy hat, boots. You know, I had to lose the cowboy hat when I came over here. But it was, so this horse, I ran the horse to Futurity. And he ran second, just got beat. So it sort of gave me a little bit of a, like, hey, this is all right. So then I ran him again in Globe, Arizona. And he ran really well. He wasn't really that great of a horse, but he ran a big race again. He ran second. So all of a sudden, there was, apparently there was this, they had just changed the testing in Arizona, so at that time, and so they picked up all these big trainers with Ritalin.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, this one of the biggest trainers, he got caught, and he had all these good horses, and this Ray Yeh, he got one too. So then I'm still working at this farm. So this Ray A calls me up. He says, "Hey Bob," he says, I'm gonna have to be suspended, and I think I'm gonna get about, they're gonna give me 6 months, the suspension." I said, "Well, why don't you, will you train these horses?" I said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "You know, I've got like 20 of them or 10 of, you know," and he had some good horses. I go, and I got to thinking. I said, "I would never train again. I didn't want to do it."
Right.
But I always thought, you know what, I could never win like the big one. It was still bugging me. I could never get him, you know. I get in the red zone, I just couldn't get push the ball, you know.
Sure. Over.
So, you know what, I said, okay, I'll do it. So I told the guy I was working for, you know what, I'm out of here. It's getting too cold anyway in Prescott in the fall. So I'll never forget, I went down to Rialto. I didn't have any money. So I went to my grandmother and I said, I need to borrow $1,000 for 30 days. I will pay you back. Oh, you kids, you never pay me back. You know? I said, I'm telling you, I'm going to pay you back. And, but I need $1,000. I have to buy equipment. I'm going to start my little business here. I'm going to start training. And she'd always say, well, how much are you going to make? Well, I don't know yet. Well, you know, remember, net is what counts. You always tell me she's sharp. It's my dad's mother. So she gave me the $1,000. I went and bought my buckets. I found this Hispanic groom that I knew down there. And I had my barn ready. And I called Ray. He said, I'm ready. When are you going to send them? I said, okay, we're ready. So he sent me 8 horses.
Okay.
And so I was back in action.
And that's where it all started.
And it started again. There again. And I was like, so the opening week, the horse that almost killed me, I had him in, I got him, I worked him. It was a little Derby, the Rialto Derby. So I ran him in the Rialto Derby, and he won it. And that was my first stakes win. I was like, oh man,
I'm back.
This horse that, but you know what? I go back. See, I was being a nice guy that I am. That I did him a favor working that horse.
Right.
And he didn't pay me to work the horse. I just did it as a favor.
Yeah.
You know, he told me, you know what? He remembered that. So when it happened, he says, you know what? I want you to train it. And I won like 3 races that weekend. And then I started getting calls from other guys that this other guy had. And all of a sudden, next thing you know it, I had like 20 horses in my barn.
Wow. And so how many winners did you have when you were training quarter horses? What was your total there? Do you know?
You know what? I don't know offhand. I know I had about, I think I had like about 1,700 or 1,800 starters.
Okay.
But I don't know. I can't. It might be in the book, my book.
Yeah.
You know, the Dirt Road of the Derby.
Sure.
You can find it in some tack shops around America. Gift shops, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think they even carry the gift shop here in San Diego, but that's how bad it is.
No respect.
No respect.
So what eventually led to the decision to get involved with thoroughbreds then?
Well, I mean, I got rolling in quarter horses, so then I got, you know what, and Bobby Adair, the jockey, I remember when I was trying to be a jockey, I was at Rialto one time and I was riding. I wasn't, you know, I did it just for sport. And he asked me one time, because I'd been at Los Alamitos, I won a couple races there as a jockey in the Bay Meadows. Dr. Allred, who hired me to gallop his horses one summer,
yeah,
and put me on some horses. So so I was at Rialto, and he goes, you coming out to Los Alamitos this summer? And I was fighting my weight. I was too big. I said, no, I'm not coming. Why not? He goes, you know what? I'm just not good enough. Well, if you don't think you're good enough, you need to quit, because you're going to get killed riding with these guys out here. It's,
yeah,
it's not good.
Yeah, it's cutthroat.
Yeah, so I went home that night and I'm thinking like, and I was still going to college, you know.
Okay.
You know, I was doing that, so I thought, you know what? Here's a point. So the next day I came in, I rode one horse or two. I quit that day. And I just gave all my stuff away. I wish I would have kept my saddle and stuff.
You know? Yeah.
I never thought I was going to amount to anything anyway. So so I quit and just, you know, finished school, and then I got these jobs down the road. But it was, to me, it really, you know, if you're not if you can't be like really good at it, don't do it.
Yeah.
So I always remembered those words, and so when I was in relief, when I started training quarter horses, I really wanted to have the best quarter horses. So I really was into it, and my dad was really into it. He loved coming, watching me win these races, and then we're Relito during the winter. He'd come up, and it was just fun.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun. We didn't, you know, the horses won, they made $300.
Right.
They get $30, you know. And then if they, you know, we would go to the, if we won a big race, you know, we'd go to the, at the time it was, what's that? The Red Lobster. That was huge. if we won a big one, it was Red Lobster, dude. That's where we went to celebrate. But it was just a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden racing sort of ran out in Arizona. They closed Relito, and I love Relito. I would just win almost everything there. Won a lot of races. And so I decided to, I remember it was during the Olympics in L.A., Brad McKenzie, he was working at Los Alamos. He was a really dear friend, good friend of mine. He was like the older brother. He was like one of the brothers, you know.
Yeah.
He's younger than me, but he was like one of the brothers. And he said, why don't you come out to Los Alamitos? I said, there's a new race secretary. Maybe he'll give you some stalls, you know, because the old one, he was tough. He was just, I tried stalls one year. He gave me one stall, and I'll never forget. It was my dad's horse, and I brought two horses, and I had one there, and I'll never forget, his name was Curly Smith. He was tough, and he brought me into his office, and I had this horse. He bucked in a race. He came out of the gate, and he bucked, and his name was Baffert's Ruler, and it was weird. He never bucked before, so I had to qualify him. You know, at those days, you had to qualify him out of the gate. So he qualified, he worked, and I said, am I okay? He says, no, I want you to work him again, qualify him again. I go, but he worked. He says, you know what, son? You need to come see me in my office. He was tough. This guy was tough. And so I'll never forget. I went in his office. I was scared to death. This guy was like, he was tough. Anybody that trained quarter horse, it was Curly Smith. He was tough. So he says, let me tell you something. If I tell you you need to qualify that horse, you don't argue with me. You don't say anything. Matter of fact, Mr. Baffert, he said, how many stalls did I give you? I go, one. And where did you come in from? I come from Nogales, Arizona. Well, usually when you give somebody from out of state one stall, that usually means they're not going to come, and I really don't want you to come. He said that, and I go, well, then I was like, well, I said, so, and you showed up. I can't believe you showed up. You know, so, all right, so that was it. So I said, all right, Mr. Smith, you know, don't worry, I'll never. So I really got a good schooling that day, but I'll never forget that. And really, actually, he was doing me a favor. I should have stayed home because the horse wasn't, we didn't do any good at all. So, but then when I did come back, I had like 40 really good horses, 40 horses in the training. So what I did, they gave me 8 stalls at Los Alamitos. And so I picked my 8 best horses and I brought them out that winter. And I thought, oh, I was scared to death. I was nervous, like, man. So, and I remember I had my first 3 horses in the first night that I was going to run horses the night. And I had my best filly in. She was an allowance filly. And I had 2 other ones in that were really good. I just went ahead and I went with my aces, you know. The first one ran 3rd. And I'm used to winning a lot of races in Arizona. I mean, I was winning a lot, you know. The second one ran 4th. And I told Brad McKenzie, boy, if this filly, if she doesn't do any good in this next race, my best one, I'm going to have to, I'm leaving. I'm not,
slink out of town.
I have no business here. So her name was 5 o'clock Rush. She was in the one hole. And she broke, and she won by a head. And it was like, I needed that. That was like, if she would have run 4th, I might have just, you know what, I'm in over my head. I don't need to be here.
Yeah.
You know, and so that really, I needed that. You always need that little encouragement, you know. And so, and after that, I started doing well, and then people saw I was doing well, and that's how I got my horses. They started sending me horses, and then the next, that's, I went back that winter, and I grouped up, and then I just left Arizona and came in the summer, and pretty soon I had, you know, 60 horses, and I was winning a lot of the big races. And, you know, once you get that, when I first went to Los Alamitos, it's all about getting that confidence. Like, you're seeing people that I could never train with these people.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's like, and then once you know you can do it, it's like, wow, I can do this. I can, you know. And so the same thing happened with when I thought about thoroughbred racing. I came over here, and I was really, like, the first time I claimed a horse at Del Mar, Mike Pegram said, here, there's some money, you know, claim a horse. So I go down there, and I was panicking. It was in the afternoon, and the traffic is so bad. And I'm going to claim this horse. So I'm thinking, I got to get down there, and I got to get a license, and I got to fill out a claim. And so the cell phones were just coming out then, and I had a cell phone in my car. So I call up the stewards. I'll never forget the stewards. And this girl answers the phone. She goes to the steward's office. He goes, yes, I want to claim a horse today in the third race, but I need to get my trainer's license.
Right.
She goes, and I'm stuck in traffic, so, I mean, I need to get in there. Will there be somebody there to do it? Well, I don't think so. You won't have time. You know, to get a trainer's license, you know, you got to fill out the test, and, you know, you got to the stewards, and then you're cutting it a little bit close. I mean, this is something. I go, have you ever been licensed anywhere else? I say, I've been licensed in Arizona, and I train horses at Los Alamitos. Oh, you train horses at Los Alamitos? I go, yeah. Well, you're already licensed. Oh, really? So I don't need a – no, it's the same. You're already licensed. Oh, I didn't know that. What's your name? Bob Baffert. Oh, yeah, you don't – you're fine. So I told her, could you do me a favor? She said, sure. Could you not tell anybody this story? I don't want anybody to know. She laughed. I forget who it was, you know. So I went down there, and I saw this horse. So I filled it out. I was all nervous. Claiming a horse is nerve-wracking. I'm telling you, it is nerve-wracking. I'd rather buy an expensive horse at a yearling sale, but claiming a horse is nerve-wracking.
Really?
You know? Yeah. So I go over there. I fill it out. You got to be perfect. I put the claim in. And I never forget, it was a Mike Mitchell horse. He was in the one hole. And they came out of the gate. The gate opens. And the horse doesn't come out of the gate. He dwelt. Just stayed in the gate.
Nice.
And I go, oh, wow, that's not good. This is not good. It was like for $32,000. So I go down there. You know, I go down there, you know, mask it around. Hey, where do I get the claim tag for this horse I just claimed? And I go, where's the claim? There was no claims in the race. No, I dropped a claim. I go, oh, are you Bob Baffert? I go, yeah. Oh, here, you forgot to put the name of the horse in there.
Oh, no.
I go, oh, thank God. So I'm driving back, and I'm calling Mike Pegram. I go, I tell him what happened. I go, oh, my God, you talk about the I always say the Lord takes care of the pendejos, you know. I said, I'm telling you what, I got so lucky this horse didn't come out of the gate. We got lucky there. So the next time I went back, I claimed a horse off of
And this is your introduction into thoroughbred racing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, with my cowboy hat. So then I go back. I find this other horse. I wanted to find a horse that was a maiden that maybe would get beat first time I could win a race with it. So there was a horse called Hidden Royalty and belonged to it was Brian Mayberry was training it. And I didn't know anybody. Brian Mayberry from anybody. So I claimed the horse, big good-looking horse, and he wins for 32. But it was like barely won. And Alex Elise wrote it. I'll never forget. And so I claim the horse, and I get it. And later on, I find out from April Mayberry, who worked for me, her dad says, hey, go find who the dumb cowboy was that claimed our horse. So I claim the horse, and I take him back, and I haul him right to Los Alamitos. I take him right to Los Alamitos because
right.
I didn't have any stalls, you know. So I remember calling Mike Pegram. I go, yeah, I claimed one from Brian Mayberry. He goes, oh, from the Seagulls. Oh, man, they got good horses, but they usually don't give anything away. They're pretty tough. Well, I don't know. He looked pretty good to me, Mike. Looks good. So a couple of days later, he's got this big old – he had a big old splint on him, and he had like – you know, but he was just a horse. He wasn't all that. So I cut him immediately. I gelded him. And So I remember I brought him over here to work. I hauled him up here to work him.
It's Santa Anita.
Yeah. So I'm waiting down there at the bottom by the clockers thing down there. I'm trying to get somebody to work them. And I see Alex Elise is talking there. And I says, hey, his agent, can Alex Elise work this horse for me? Because he won on him, and you know, I'm going to run him back, and he can ride him, you know. He said, well, let me go ask him. And they're down there talking. He goes, no, I can't. He's busy. Can't work him right now. Oh, really? So this horse is, I'm just going and turning in a circle. I'm looking for somebody to work him, right? So finally about 15, 20 minutes goes by, and the track's open, and Alex Elise is still there. So he says, hey, he hasn't left the spot. Can he work him? He says, nah, he doesn't want to work him, and he really doesn't want to ride him. I said, damn. I never forgot that, though.
Right.
All right. So I go, all right, okay. So I took him back. I just said, you know what, I'll just work him at Los Alamitos, you know. So I took him back. So then I ran him back, and he ran last a couple of times. He got beat a block. You know, I don't blame him for not riding him. So then I thought, you know what, I'm gonna lose interest in this. I'm used to winning races. I'm not. This is terrible because I'm winning 3-4 races a week at Los Alamitos. You know, and I have Tim Yakteen. He's working for me. I brought him over from the quarter horses. Okay. So we're going in this together. We don't know what we're doing. So finally, I need help. So I called up. I needed Bob Bedeker, you know, Brad McKenzie and Bob Bedeker, and he sold the sheet here. He says, Bob, I need some help. I want to claim a horse, and I don't know what I'm doing. I said, can you find me a horse? And he said, yeah, I'll look for one. So he calls me up. He says, there's a horse called President Summit. He's in for $50,000 to bring him in from Hastings Park. And the trainer was he's not here. He was a pretty good trainer. Leonard Dorfman.
Okay.
They sent him down here. Oliveros was on the horse, Frank Oliveros. So I go down there, fill out the claim. Look, beautiful horse. I just throw the claim in there, and I'm watching him. And we got our halter, and I'm watching him there behind the winner's circle because I couldn't get upstairs. I could not get a pass to go upstairs.
They wouldn't give you a pass?
No, I didn't. Couldn't get up there.
Yeah.
The boxes and stuff. I couldn't. It would not let me up there. So.
But how times have changed.
I know. So I'm out there with Tim, and all of a sudden I told him, if this horse doesn't do well, screw it. I'm going back to, forget this thoroughbred deal.
Right.
So all of a sudden the horse comes up and the horse wins. Oh my! We were so excited. We were jumping up and down. I mean, I wanted to go in the winner's circle. I was so excited. I mean, I felt like running in there, like, I wonder if we can go in the winner's circle. It's our horse now, you know?
Right.
So we go down there, and where's my tag, you know? Am I shaking with anybody? No, it's all yours. And we're like, we walked behind that horse all the way up, just so excited, and went to the test barn, got the horse. Called up Mike and said, oh, man, what a horse. What a beautiful horse. What a difference. So I had him here. So now I've had two stalls here, Hidden Royalty, the one I'd claim, and his President Summit. So after a few days, I got to take him to the track to gallop. So I get him tacked up. So I told Tim, I said, get him tacked up, and I'll go find somebody to gallop him.
Yeah, where's Alex Elise?
So at Los Alamitos, all my jockeys gallop my horses there.
Okay.
That's the way it works. So I didn't know any difference. So I walk up there, and I see Gary Stevens. I said, hey, Gary, Bob Baffin. Oh, yeah, I know. He says, yeah. Hey, I just claimed this horse, and do you have time? You do anything right now? I said, no. He says, can you gallop him for me? And he goes, sure. So I go, oh, great. So he goes back there, put him on the horse, and I says, oh, what do you want me to do with him? I don't know, whatever they do here, you know, just, well, they backtrack and gallop. Yeah, just do that. That's fine with me. So he takes him, he gallops, and he came back. He says, man, he's nice. He goes, man, will you ride him? He said, sure, just talk to my agent. So we're unsaddling, and this friend is Mike Malika, who was stable there, and we were stable there called Ankle Alley, where they film Seabiscuit. That's where they put all the gyps, you know. We're all down there. All the two-horse stables. It's Jip Row there, I'm telling you. It's like you got to order your grain like one bag at a time because it'll disappear, right? You can't order. You can't fill it up there. It'll be gone, you know. So he tells me, how did you get Gary Stevens to gallop your horse? Well, I just asked him. He says, well, you don't do that, dude. It's not cool. Oh, I didn't know. So then I saw Gary the next day said, "Hey, man, I'm sorry, man. I didn't know. You know, I wasn't doing nothing." So,
this is where the relationship with Gary Stevens.
Exactly.
Began. Okay.
You know, so Lee should have worked that horn. Yeah. So then they, I tried to get Gary on him. I talked to his agent. He had a different age at the time. I said, "Hey, will you ride this horse, President Summit?" And he said, "Yeah, I just claimed him for 50." He said, "I'll ride him for 40, but I won't ride him for 62.5. I said, "Well, that's not nice." So I got Oliveras, and he said, "Yeah, I'll ride him back." And he won for 62.5, and I mean, that was it.
It was like you won the Kentucky Derby.
I won the Kentucky Derby, and I thought, this is it. I'm gonna give myself 3 years. Because that's what I thought. I'll give it 3 years. If it doesn't work, I'll go back. I can always go back. And I just needed something. And that President Summit, that's why Bob Bedecker, you know, I'm indebted to him because he helped me find that horse. But that's what really got me going in the business.
We have about 5 minutes left, so we're not going to get to Silver Charm. We're not going to get to Real Quiet. We're not going to get to all the big name horses that you've had. You'll have to agree to come back for a part two up the road, and we'll handle all that then. But when you look back at the story you've just laid out and the way you started and coming from Nogales and just learning from your dad, could you ever imagine that you'd be sitting here today at Santa Anita as a Hall of Fame trainer, having won all those derbies, all the Triple Crown races, and all those Breeders' Cups?
It wasn't even a thought or a dream. I mean, I remember watching the Kentucky Derby. We'd all get together to watch the Kentucky Derby on our little black and white sets at my uncle's house, because our TV was always out because we had antenna, the cows kept knocking it down. And so we'd have to go across the street to his house to go watch it. And it was just amazing that I remember going to First September set with my cowboy hat with this Bill Mitchell. I trained his Gold Coast Express, was a world champion quarter horse.
Sure.
And I thought it was a big shot at the time. We went to September sale, says, "Let's go to Claiborne Farm. Claiborne, I want to look see what a good horse looks like so I'll know what I'm looking at." So we go there in the morning. I walk up to the receptionist there, and I said, "You know, I'm Bob Baffert. This is Bill Mitchell. You know, we have the world champion quarter horse, and we'd like to just see the horses." "Well, the tour doesn't start for another hour." "Well, I'm not here to be on the tour. I don't need a tour guide. Just turn me loose there, and I just want to look at it, just get an idea." "Well, let me asked Mr. Hancock. So he comes back and he says, "Yeah, you're going to have to wait for the tour." So we waited there for an hour. So then I got, but you know what? I got to see Secretariat, and I looked at him. I go, wow. He was like so huge, his shoulder and his neck, but his hind end was real light.
Yeah.
But his feet were really in bad shape at the time, you know. And so, but his shoulder was just massive. And then I saw Spectacular Bid, who really wasn't a specimen to look at. He was light boned, had a nice frame, but nothing really, you know. And I saw Mr. Prospector. He was a little short with the head up, you know. He was nice, but. And Nijinsky II, he looked real, what I call at the time, thoroughbredy light. And then, but Danzig, when they brought him out, I said, "Oh, yeah, that's my horse."
Yeah.
He looked like a quarter horse. Beautiful horse, and I'll forget that. But. I mean, so it was humbling at first, but it really, the thoroughbred racing has really taken me and my family to this. I've got to throw out pitches at ballparks with my kid. I never would have dreamt that. It's taken me to a whole different level. And you meet interesting people, and there's some nice fans. That's why, to me, when I see fans, they want me to do this or that. I love it because I was a fan. I just love it. And I know what they feel like because I was there. And when I saw greatness or something, to me, I still see a great horse run. You know, I love watching that.
And you have that personality that people, Bob, are just attracted to. You're a great ambassador, a great spokesperson for the game. And obviously from this interview here tonight, you've never forgotten where you came from. And I can't thank you enough for spending a little time here with me. And again, we'll have to come back on for a part two, and we'll take it from here, and we'll look ahead to all those big races that you won, or we'll look back on those big races. And boy, it's been an amazing career and still rolling.
Hey, the dirt road of the Derby, that was the hard part.
Yeah. That was the hard part. Bob Baffert here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Trainer Talk, all presented by Phasic Tipton. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of this show here tonight, go back to our website, horseracingradio.net. A podcast will be available for you to listen at your leisure. Been an awful lot of fun. Bob, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Don't forget, next Wednesday, we are back with this very same program, 6 to 7 Eastern. Visit our website, horseracingradio.net, for all the SiriusXM channel information, all the live streaming, and all the podcasts as we continue to take you down that road to the Breeders' Cup here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. For Bob Baffert, my producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penna. We will talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.